The First Tee with Robbie Greenfield and Zane Scotland. Brought to you by the DP World Tour, the race to Dubai.
Hello, one and all. Welcome along to another edition of the First Tee podcast with myself, Robbie Greenfield, and Zane Scotland. In this episode, we build up to the finale of the DP World Tour season. We're in conversation with the director of the Ryder Cup and deputy CEO of the DP World Tour, not to mention one of the most prominent figures in the business of golf over the past three decades, Guy Kinnings. Guy reflects on a job well done in Rome. He looks ahead to the next chapter of a Ryder Cup rivalry. Plus, we discuss the landscape of professional golf as the sport strives to innovate and capture a new audience heading into 2024. Welcome along then to another episode of the First Tee podcast with the DP World Tour. We're almost there in terms of finishing the season. We've got 2 weeks left to go. The DP World Tour Championship looming large on the horizon. Mr. Zane Scotland back in studio with me. He's come out to Dubai ostensibly to, well, help me put the podcast together, but also to play a lot of golf and enjoy himself out there on the courses of Dubai. I say a very warm welcome, as always, to Mr. Zane Scotland.
Hello, buddy. Yeah, work, all work. It's playing golf, talking golf, thinking about golf. It's all work, but yeah, happy days.
I've got to figure out a way to make my job just a little bit more resembling of yours because it's brilliant. Where have you played? What have you been up to?
So got a couple of pals over, showing them around some of the nice sights of Dubai. So far, I played the Earls Club, played Dubai Hills. The weather is just turning here. It's getting absolutely fantastic. And yes, enjoying it. Popping into the studio before playing golf this afternoon, which I'm sure you won't be happy to
hear about. No, I'm not. I'm stuck in the office this afternoon. I am trying to get out on the golf course with you. I don't think I've ever asked you this. Favourite course in Dubai?
That is a really tricky one. I had this conversation yesterday. I'm going to say Dubai Creek because it's been really kind to me and I've won Mina Tour events there. And it is the oldest course and it kind of reminds me of being back in the UK. It's a bit more of an old school golf course.
Dubai Creek, incidentally, back on the schedule for the DP World Tour for the first time, oh my word, since the early 2000s, I think, maybe even 1999, when it actually hosted for a couple of years the Desert Classic. I think David Howell won.
I was going to say
Dubai
that.
Creek.
I remember watching David Howell come down the stretch and win that tournament, because obviously the 17th and 18th hole are so iconic. And yeah, when it moved there for a couple of years, David Howell did the business.
Thomas Bjorn, a former winner of the Desert Classic, one of the legends on the DP World Tour. He is the man that was tasked with the redesign of Dubai Creek. I think it's a really tricky, fiddly golf course. I'm really intrigued to see how they set it up for the top players on the DP World Tour, because it's not the longest course in the world. It's coming in at around about 6,900, 7,000 yards. I'm sure they'll be able to push it a little bit, but it's breezy and quite tricky on its day. If they get the rough up, I think it will pose a test.
It is, because even though it's quite short, it's not necessarily, you can't just smash it all the way down there. There's, you know, got dog legs. I think they'll tighten up some of the fairways. But, you know, most of the course, it's all one big build-up to get into that 17th and 18th hole. So I think we're going to see a really good tournament there.
Okay. It's proof, by the way, anyone listening to this podcast, that no matter how good you are at the game of golf, your favourite course always strongly correlates with where you have played your best golf.
That's literally it.
And that's it. Zane has won on the Dubai Creek, ergo it is his favourite course in Dubai. We're in conversation with Guy Kinnings in this episode of the podcast, Zane, a man you know, a man you had dealings with, I believe, when you turned professional yourself a couple of decades ago. Talk me through that. Talk me through your first meeting with Guy Kinnings, who's, I think, for anyone not well versed in the kind of business of golf, he has been a prominent figure in the world of golf for three decades plus. He had a mentorship with the legendary Mark McCormack, who we'll talk a little bit more about perhaps a little bit later on in this episode. He's also now risen to the point where he's been in management. He's been the head of golf for IMG. He's moved over now with the DP World Tour the last few years. He's the deputy CEO of the DP World Tour, and he's also the director of the Ryder Cup. And I don't think anyone can quibble with the job that he did, he and his team in Rome, putting on and staging that incredible Ryder Cup. But a couple of decades ago, when you turned pro, you met Guy. First impressions of him, what were your dealings with him?
Yeah, very slick. Like, you know, he's a very, very sharp guy. As you said there, he wears many hats in that respect, you know, and sits in some really prominent positions. But he's a guy, he's so switched on. He's the guy, he will meet you once for 30 seconds and then you won't see him for 2 years, and he'll ask you a question about that small snippet of conversation you had, and then he'll be able to pivot to the next person sat in the courtesy car and ask them about their family. He's just obviously a very interesting guy, very well versed guy in terms of golf. When I first met him, would have been when I was just thinking about turning pro, and I wasn't really thinking about, you know, the commercial side of it. To me, it was all about just the golf, golf, golf. My dad and I went down to McCormack House in Chiswick, just off of Kew Bridge. Beautiful, small, kind of quaint office, which was really well kept. We got given a little tour of the office, and the big kind of crescendo of the tour was going to Mark McCormack's office up in the corner, which he would frequent once a year when he was over for Wimbledon for the tennis. And wherever he like left his pen on the desk, that's where it would be a year later. It was like walking into a museum. No one, it was like you had to whisper like as you went in, sort of thing. And then, yeah, and then after the tour, we would go downstairs. Brendan Taylor would go on to be my manager at the time, and he kind of worked underneath Guy. Guy at that point, so this would have been 2001, I think he joined IMG in 1989. So, you know, 12 or 13 years at the helm there. And, yeah, he came in and, you know, like he does, you know, just sells you the dream. You know, that's what, yeah, he's the man for that. You know, you kind of walk out there feeling like you're going to be the next Tiger Woods, you know, every young golfer wants to hear. And that was it. There was, after that meeting, there was no other management company even in our thoughts after that. It was just like that was the only place to be. And at the time, IMG Golf, especially in Europe, was Guy Kinnings. That's what he looked after. Colin Montgomery, who at the time was just absolutely bossing European golf. And, you know, whatever Guy said went, basically. You know, he was top of the tree. And IMG had a real hold on golf at the time, because at that point, you know, it was very much about, even though golf wasn't maybe the biggest income part of it, you know, the production company is where the real big money starts. But because IMG had started in golf with the handshake with Arnold Palmer, that was always held in such high esteem.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, that's a legendary story in itself. The fact that the whole business, the whole model of professional sport, not just golf, changed forever back in 1960 when Arnold Palmer shook hands with Mark McCormack. We are going to get into this conversation with Guy Kinnings. That must be, by the way, a really overwhelming experience for a young player when you enter that world for the first time. You leave amateur golf behind you, and for you as well, because I know there was a lot of buzz around you when you turned pro. That must have been a huge transition for you to have to deal with when you walked into that world and were confronted with all of these people in suits kind of making promises and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't ready for it, because at that point, as a youngster, you're just playing golf and you're here to do that, and you think that all happens by magic. And then when you go into that office environment and you get walked around the office, go, these are the two accountants, these are the lawyers that are going to deal with this. This is where the agent is. This is where the PAs are. This is where Guy's office is. All of a sudden, you think, what have I got into here? Like, it was so far removed from anything. I had no preconceptions of that's how it worked. I just thought you play good golf, and then all the other pieces happen, and you realise the actual playing of golf is a relatively small cog in the massive wheel of what goes on in golf production.
Right, let's get into this conversation then with Guy Kinnings. He first reflects on a job well done in Rome. He is the director of the Ryder Cup, as well as being the deputy CEO of the DP World Tour. And we had to start there by reflecting on that magnificent performance by Team Europe to regain the Ryder Cup in Rome.
It's being described, and the stats bear out that it was, hey, this was in many ways the greatest Ryder Cup we've seen, one of the best, you know, sporting events people have been treated to. But you've got to remember, going into it, that wasn't quite what was expected. So, you know, Europe were on the end of a record defeat, Whistling Straits, against a very strong US team. And we were going to a country in Italy that had never hosted a Ryder Cup before, and it was new to them. So in a sense, what you describe was that extraordinary performance by Luke, the team around him, and his team within the ropes, which was, as you say, and you describe it beautifully, I mean, it was euphoric from the moment they arrived, from the moment they got things going on Friday, and through the pressure of Saturday afternoon and Sunday. They were an unbelievable team, astonishing team, and the way that they pulled together the experience, the big stars who stood up, the rookies who were brilliant. Luke's leadership was amazing, but equally, we were so excited because outside the ropes, things worked. It was a brilliant week. You know, what went on on the first tee, what went on during the week in preparation, the crowds were wonderful. I mean, you know, it was an extraordinary atmosphere, and everything worked. People got in, they had the enjoyment of being in this amazing city in Rome, And it made it all incredibly memorable. So, yeah, no, you're absolutely right. We're all sitting here very pleased with what happened. I've asked Mr. Donald to go and take some time to himself. He and Diane deserve a rest. They've done brilliantly. And a lot of the players went straight on, but, you know, they should all be going on with a big smile. They did an absolutely wonderful job as Taurus.
You've been around, Guy, great captains on the European side. You've been around some great leaders in the business of golf. Luke Donald, he's a quiet individual. He's not a particularly outspoken guy. Europe have probably had more extroverted captains, if you want to put it like that. But what really impressed you about Luke and the way he went about his business as captain?
Luke did an absolutely brilliant job. There's no other way of describing it. From the moment he started to work on it, he and Diane attacked it with a thoroughness, with a thoughtfulness, with a quiet inner strength that Luke's always had. And you know, I've been lucky. I've seen players and captains since I first went to a Ryder Cup professionally in 91, and I've worked with a number of fantastic captains in that time. I've also worked with Luke. I managed him when he was on tour, and Luke was always underestimated. You know, people always said, "Oh, you know, he's not big enough to hit it, Miles. He doesn't drive hard enough." World number one, steely determination. He's a cold. Eyes on the prize, he's absolutely brilliant, and he always has been. And what he brought to that team from the moment that he started working with them, there was an air of confidence that, and he learned from all of those previous captains, all of those people that you just described. Luke's an intelligent guy. He's very smart. He's thoughts. He thinks about things. He takes notes. He has learned from all the captains he's worked with. He was a very good vice captain as well as a brilliant Ryder Cup player.
Yeah.
And he assimilated thoughts. He brought in people that would help him. He worked with us to structure things in a different way. He did lots of things that hadn't been done before. You know, we did the Hero Cup, as we were just talking about, in Abu Dhabi. He did team visits in advance. He did other things that a lot of the players have talked about as saying that was transformational. It had the players ready, prepared for the week, ready to go out and achieve at their highest. And he did that for each and every player in the team as a whole. So it was a fantastic job. It's one he should be hugely proud of. And in many ways, what he did was he kind of took the best from experience and what had gone before, added his own unique insights and approach. And he transformed. I mean, again, you know, Luke has been seen as a quiet guy. When you saw him stand up at that opening ceremony, flawless Italian, brilliant speech. And some of us were lucky enough to hear him speak during the week to the players. He became a wonderful leader, and he got the result he deserved.
There was obviously some chatter at the end of Luke potentially going again in 2 years' time. You just referenced it there. The job is a full-time one. He's playing as well on tour. It takes a lot out of you. And, you know, in many ways, why would he risk his legacy as an already winning Ryder Cup captain with a brilliant Ryder Cup playing record to go to Bethpage? And yet, when he was asked about it, just from body language, it seemed like, yeah, I'm up for this if asked. Now, maybe you can detail a little bit, Guy, about what happens from here. How is the next captain selected? Is it a case of, because I know Europe have always gone a kind of one and done route with a captaincy, is it a case of maybe making an exception for Luke if he wanted to do it again? Or are you just open-minded about what happens from here? How does it work?
We have a process. As you rightly say, Luke will, and he must go away and think about and reflect. And that's exactly a Luke Donald thing to do. He'll go away and do that. Therefore, he'll come up with his own mind as to whether he even wants to be considered again. We have a process. And we work together and we listen to all of the relevant stakeholders, people who have great knowledge, players, past captains, people who work around the team, whatever else. So we will obviously go and do all the due diligence we need to do and think about that. I think he will think about whether he wants to be considered. One of the things that is very striking is it's entirely in his thought, and then we have to go through that process. But it's a very nice position for him to have been in, to see the players who he'd led, who were clearly so enthusiastic about the prospect. He'll weigh up everything that you've just described. His performance in Rome will always sit there in history, whether he's then going to be drawn to be interested in doing what, as we've already said, is going to be a very, very hard task. And, you know, he needs to do that thinking, we'll do the thinking, and then we'll make an announcement.
When I watch the Ryder Cup, Guy, as a fan of golf, it's so different to any other golfing event, even the major championships. And I don't think any sport, actually, now I think about it, has an event within its ecosystem that really can compare, because a football match is a football match and so on and so on. Whereas the Ryder Cup sort of separates itself from the rest of golf from an atmospheric point of view, from a fan engagement point of view. And I guess the billion-dollar question, and maybe there's no answer to it, is kind of how do you take a little piece of that and bring it back to the regular tour? And is that something you'd even want? Is the Ryder Cup just special because it does happen once every 2 years? Have you thought much about that? And does that keep you up at night, Guy?
It really doesn't keep me up at night, as you can imagine. It's a wonderful position to be in. You know, as I said before, we're incredibly lucky in golf to have an event like that. There are wonderful tournaments, brilliant majors, great events on the PGA Tour, DP World Tour. You know, they are in themselves great occasions, and they only get better and better. But the Ryder Cup is fundamentally different from them. It's totally unique. It's tribal. It's got this 100 years of history. It's just coming up. It's got this intense competition. The players react in a different way. The fans react in a different way. There's a totally different interest. And it's a magical moment that we have to nurture. And in many ways, the appeal is, sure, it's match play. Sure, it's intercontinental and you're playing for your country and your teammates. But there's also rarity. You know, it's every 2 years. It's only on home soil every 4 years. People look forward to it like nothing else. And whilst there are, of course, learnings that we will always take to try and make everything better that we can on the PGA Tour year in, year out, and we try and do that with the schedule, I don't know that necessarily there's that much that's transferable, because the Ryder Cup's the Ryder Cup. And we have to nurture that, make sure it's as good as it can be. And then other events certainly become events that people are drawn to in advance, tournaments where the players who are going to play are in it, in the tournaments afterwards. People will go, oh, we've got Ryder Cup players here. So it has a huge influence on the tour as a whole. But to my mind, I think it stands alone as a unique event. And I think you're right, because it is so different from the staple diet that we have, that it is quite a unique offering. And I'm not sure that there are other sports that have it. And that's why I think we're so lucky. And you've got to remember, this was an event that for many years was not as interesting as it might have been, because the US was so dominant.
Yeah,
we made the change, in came the Europeans. They galvanized that. And you now have this team where, you know, those players will not only have had the week of their lives inside the ropes, what they experience in the team room, interacting with each other, seeing how leaders on the course, like Rory and John, Victor and others, have reacted, as well as how their captains and the vice captains have done. It's a unique experience. Those guys will want to be back. They'll want to be back working out how they could win away. In the same way, I guarantee you, the US players are going to be sitting around going, how do we get this back? How do we get this back in 2 years' time? And it's that, the way the players react like they don't anywhere else. And you've got to remember, they are not playing for money. They're playing for each other. They're playing for their countries, their continents. And that's the magic of the event. And that's why people react to it in a way differently from any other event. There are wonderful tournaments for people to enjoy, but the Ryder Cup is just different.
Yeah. I mean, Scottie Scheffler, case in point, going crazy. I don't think I've ever seen that guy show emotion in a regular tournament. And there he is going crazy on the green. I want to ask you a little bit about the DP World Tour, if I can, Guy. We're just less than a month away now from the start of the DP World Tour Championship. Of course, a favourite event of ours. We absolutely love it. It is a brilliant finale to a DP World Tour season. But as we know, these are very interesting times in the world of professional golf. I want to get your view on what the most pertinent challenges are for the DP World Tour and where you see opportunities in the future.
Things are changing, and that's good. Good thing for the tour and for golf itself to evolve, and that's the way it should be. For us, I see opportunities. We have, through the strategic partnership we have, the alliance we have with the PGA Tour, we now are able to work so that the schedules are more compatible. We have a wonderful season now with its global swings, which is the uniqueness of the DP World Tour, because we go globally. We always have those events in Asia, in the Middle East, in Australasia, in South Africa, and of course the heartland in Europe. Middle East so important, as you say, at the end of the year we start, and then we start again in January. But you've got all those swings. You've now got this new creation, which is our sort of almost our heritage events, those fantastic national opens and other events that we play in what we call the back nine, and then we go to our playoffs. So the schedule's been incredibly well received. It will work together around what is a very strong PGA Tour schedule as well. So for us, we're coming off what is a wonderful season with some amazing majors and other performances by players. We have a brilliant Ryder Cup to go from. Golf's in a pretty healthy state. For sure, there are some things we need to get finalized and organized, but the future is bright. There are huge opportunities for the game to grow. People are being drawn to it, to view it, to attend. Participation numbers are up. Games, you know, it's consumed in a different way. Content is amazing. It was around the Ryder Cup. It is around the tour, gaming and everything else. So what I see is a game in pretty good health, which has got some big decisions to make, but it's coming from a position where people are interested. And so I see really strong opportunities for the future.
Yeah, I mean, if we look back at the start of your career, Guy, I would love to hear about that, because when you look back on your own career, what is the single biggest change that you've seen in professional golf in that time?
It's a really interesting question, because I am so lucky. I really am. I've had a wonderful career working in management and watching players like, as you mentioned, from the big three through to the players like Nick and others, through the Tiger era into this amazing new era we've got. And I've seen, you know, it allowed me to do all that I wanted to do before I moved into what I do with the tour and with the Ryder Cup. And I guess I don't know that there is a single thing that I would look at except to say that what you've seen is a sport that has, and you use the word change, the sport has changed. And in many ways, the beauty of golf is it has these wonderful core values. This is all about honesty. It's self-policing. It's old and young, male, female. You can go out and play with a handicap system against anyone you like. It's almost impossible to do in any other sport. So golf has these wonderful core values, but it needs to evolve and it needs to change. And what we've seen is the emergence of brilliant new events, emergence of strength in tours, the evolution of the Ryder Cup, which is our, you know, wonderful asset. But we've also been lucky. We've lived through an era, the Tiger era. And, you know, the big three set the stage. They made golf accessible. Tiger transformed it. He took it to places that it would never have been before. And every single one of us who've been lucky enough to work in it at that time owe him a huge debt of gratitude. And what you now have is it's evolving again. You know, you see all these new things happening, whether it be TGL, whether it be mixed events that we have, whether it's golf for the disabled, all of these things that are emerging in the sport, the strength of the women's game that's been evolving, a wonderful Solheim Cup in the week before the Ryder Cup, all of these things are really healthy. So I would say the biggest thing that I've seen is the evolution of the game, how a game that has wonderful core values has been able to adapt and change and to appeal to different global geographic demographic and also different, you know, groups. And, you know, people being drawn to the game. So I think that's been, in a sense, it's evolution in the many decades, as you kindly remind me that I have been working in different capacities.
Well, one of the trailblazers for professional golf was the legendary Mark McCormack. And I know that he was a mentor of yours. Yeah. I mean, what a privilege to get to work under that guy and to learn from him. What was the best piece of advice he gave you in those early years, Guy?
Mark was, I mean, he was he didn't just create a company, he created an entire business. And the principles he applied when he did that apply still now. And I was incredibly lucky to work with him. I've been incredibly lucky since then to work with people like Teddy Forsman, Ari Emanuel, others who took on that business. But to work with Mark, who loved golf, and what he saw was be respectful to the essence of the sport, but be ready to innovate. So what he did was, whilst he didn't want to do anything that would impact what is the real essence of a wonderful global sport, he wanted to commercialize it. Of course he did. He wanted it to make it more appealing for people, better for the players, better for the spectators, better for the people watching at home, and was ready to change things and break rules, but to do it respectfully. And people wouldn't think of that of Mark because he's the guy who was the agent. You know, he commercialized it all. But the reality was he did it whilst recognizing it. You need to respect the sport. And he did that brilliantly.
Any special anecdotes of working with him that you can recall? That, you know, obviously there's the legendary handshake. Just his rapport with the players seems to have been something that was impossible to emulate or to copy even.
You know, let's be honest, there was no one else doing it. So his genius in signing Arnie, Jack and Gary as the first three was because, you know, he was the first mover. I had a couple of moments with him. I mean, he would always, I used to meet him in London and he was fascinated in golf and golfers. He wanted to know everything about players and how they were playing. He loved data. I do remember I was privileged to sat between he and Arnie at Bay Hill as they both argued about who had turned golf and Arnie into Arnie. And of course, you know, Mark was going, well, you know, I created this extraordinary brand. And Arnie is smiling and looking at him going, yeah, no, I made him. I gave him the chance. But he was, I remember, and it's relevant to Luke. I remember Mark, who was wonderful and gentle, but very determined. And he wanted us to manage Luke and he wanted us to manage Nick Doherty. And I remember being dispatched to Sea Island, where the Walker Cup was being played. I don't think I'd have been welcomed back in the office if I hadn't returned with the two of them as clients. And they both played brilliantly in the Walker Cup. The GB&I team won. I returned with the client, so I was allowed back in the office. But he was just quietly determined, but also had a huge respect for not just golf. We were lucky he loved golf, but he did the same tennis and so many others. So, yeah, he was a wonderful role model.
Great to catch up with Guy Kinnings. Big thanks to him and the team at the DP World Tour for sparing the time to have a little chat with us on the First Tee podcast. Some really interesting stuff out of that interview. Guy's memories of his early dealings with Mark McCormack. I think he's very much behind the idea of Luke Donald captaining the Ryder Cup once again in Bethpage in 2025, depending on what Luke decides and how the whole process, because of course he was very keen there to stress that there is a process that they follow. It's not just on a whim. They do need to undergo that and do the proper kind of protocol. But great to chat with Guy. Really interesting to talk a bit about the landscape of professional golf. He mentioned the TGL. There was actually a breaking news story there, Zane, in the last couple of days with the TGL. It's announced now for January the 9th. We'll delve into it a little bit because I want to get your thoughts on it. But yeah, great to reflect from Guy on kind of where golf is headed. And he's a very positive guy. You can hear that in his voice, the way he approaches everything. It's why he's perhaps been so successful at what he's done. But golf has a lot of opportunity ahead of it, but also there's a lot to sort out in the professional game, isn't there?
There's still a lot of questions. We're moving into areas now that haven't been done before. It's fantastic we're seeing such innovation and all these different avenues we can go down, but there are a lot of avenues we've never been down. We know how the PGA Tour model works. We know how the DP World model works. You know, and yes, they're changing and there's small improvements and little niches we're going down with those, but we know that the base of those, we've got that. These new elements of indoor golf, you know, trying to tap into a different type of golfer, a different type of person, is completely new. And I think we've got some really good people who have a really good idea of where we should go, but nobody has the answer just yet.
Yeah, lots of ideas. You're right. It's this proliferation that people know we need to innovate and innovation is happening, but it's a bit of a pin the tail on the donkey a little bit at the moment. And I suppose until something really works, we won't know definitively or categorically which direction golf will eventually go in. Because I think there is just an acceptance that we need to move away from a very convoluted schedule of just 72-hole stroke play events.
Precisely that. What everyone's trying to do in golf and the governing bodies are trying to do, and you know what the tours are trying to do, is like, we've got the golfers who are here now. How do we capture the next golfer, and how do we capture the person that hasn't even thought about golf? It's not on their radar. So it is a slightly different offering that needs to be put out. So, like, you know, to you and I, we would know golf through tournament golf on the golf course, on a green grass golf course. You know, to go to a driving range with tech is like, oh, that's new and innovative. Whereas the next person, this TGL, that might become their golf. Like, they may consume golf, and golf is indoors, completely indoors, and never venture out into a golf course, and they become an expert in that. TrackMan, for instance, one of the launch monitors, they have a professional golf tour, which is all indoors, which, you know, 10 years ago would have been like, that's ridiculous. You know, that can't happen. But now we're seeing that, you know, I think we'll see over the next 10, 15, 20 years, we'll see golfers who will they'll consume golf completely different to how you and I have had it, Robbie, and which is a good thing. But no one in it now knows that, knows what that this person that they don't necessarily have already met wants from golf. Do they want music on the golf course, or do they want the quiet traditional golf that we have? No one's got the answers in it. Everyone's guessing a little bit. Like, let's get this celebrity in. They'll bring people to golf. But then, you know, the people are there for that celebrity. They're not really there for the golf part of it. And then one of the barriers with golf is, I think getting into golf is so easy now. You can consume golf in so many different ways. It's absolutely no problem. But the next part is like, I like golf for this reason, so I want to go here. And where do you go from there? There's some exciting, you know, projects in the offing. But everyone's worked out this piece of like, you know, whether it be going to a driving range or a crazy golf or golf with friends at a golf course. But no one's quite worked out the, what about the second time or a third time of golf? Everyone's still guessing at that part.
Yeah, one thing is sure. Unfortunately, Zane, I hate to say this, you and I are not the target market for the marketeers
exactly.
out there. We
exactly
are over
that.
The hill. Yeah. We're not interesting. We're already captured.
Yeah, they got us.
They know that we're going to be watching
life.
Golf. Yeah,
room
exactly. Yeah, exactly that. We're kind of bound now to the game of golf. And yeah, they're really searching for the Gen Zs, the 20-somethings, trying to get them into the game. And that's the next big puzzle that everyone's trying to solve. And then, of course, you've got the other situation, which is, of course, how things are all going to come together with the public investment fund, this truce that was called, this ceasefire in this war that's been going on in professional golf as well. Earlier on this summer, that's gone very quiet. The deal which Jay Monahan is brokering with the public investment fund has gone quiet. There's not much in the way of new headlines coming out of that. So I don't know how that's going to shake out, because all I'm seeing right now when I'm looking at the game of golf is LIV Golf is ploughing off in continuing to do so in the direction that it's taken. And likewise, the existing infrastructure, the traditional world of golf, if you like, the PGA Tour, the DP World Tour, the new league, which we'll talk about now. There's still a dividing line. There's still a big line drawn in the sand, and that announcement earlier this summer hasn't really changed that.
Yeah, we haven't had any more information since that day watching Jay Monahan and Yassir on the television on the news channel. But yeah, it seems like it's interesting though. Everyone's making positive moves still. Everyone's moving forward in professional golf. It does now cater to a much wider market. You know, there's that part, which is a good thing. Essentially, I think we're still just trying to get a hold of what is the identity of, I think golf's got an identity, is getting the identity there now. It's becoming more entertainment, leisure, people get that part of it. But professional golf is just going through that little stage, that little era of like, where are we at? What's the next direction? Where has it got to go?
Yeah, I think you can play music all you want, and you can make it, for want of a better word, younger and more fun, and drag it from its very gentrified kind of origins into a much more modern kind of package, if you like, and maybe emulate some other sports that do that. You see events in like tennis, changeovers, they're playing loud music. At the end of the day, it's got to be compelling. And I think that's the sort of elixir, if you like, the kind of puzzle that everyone's trying to solve. How do you make the fans really buy into what's going on here? And on that note, let's talk a little bit about this new TGL, because there's been headlines these last couple of days that it will launch on the January the 9th, that we know that it's fronted by the two biggest names in professional golf, Tiger Woods, by far the biggest, and I'd say the biggest active player right now, Rory McIlroy. Don't think there's any argument about that. It's a new high-tech golf league. It will feature 15 of the current world's top 20. So they've done what LIV failed to do, let's be honest. LIV did get a few, but they've got the critical mass of the top players on the planet to buy into this. And it's run by Tomorrow Sports, which is the company technology-based, founded and established by Tiger and Rory last year. It'll run from January the 9th. It will finish just before the Masters. So it sits in that early season part of the schedule. And it's something totally different, Zane. I'm still on the fence. I need to wait and see what this actually looks like when I turn on my TV, how much it does pull you in and how much drama it's able to create. But in a nutshell, Events will be played over 15 holes. It's a team event. So once again, going down that model where they're trying to capture that essence of the team golf that, Liv went after. It's held at the Sophie Center at the Palm Beach State College in Florida. That's going to host each event in front of a relatively modest-sized 1,600 spectators. So we're not talking about a sellout stadium here. It's going to be quite an intimate event. There's going to be 6 four-man teams. 5 of them have been announced. New York, Boston, LA, San Fran, at Atlanta. So the franchise model, I think we can safely say, that's so successful in other American sports, is being deployed here. It's being backed by Steph Curry, the likes of him, the NBA superstar, the tennis star Serena and Venus Williams. Liverpool football club owners Fenway Sports Groups are involved with the Boston side. So they've got all the big hitters and they've got all the big names. 15 of the top 20, you name it. Justin Thomas, Scottie Scheffler, Patrick Cantlay, Ricky Fowler, Colin Morikawa, Max Homer. I could go on and on. I think we get the gist. Let's talk a little bit about the format. There'll be 9 holes followed by 6 holes. The 9 holes will be called triples, which will be alternate shot between 3 of the 4 team members. Okay? So it's foursomes, but it's not. It's called triples. Then you've got in the next stage, the final 6 holes will be singles. It'll be one player, but each team member plays 2 holes. So only 3 of the 4 team members will be deployed at a given event. And any match that ends in a tie goes to overtime where they have this nearest the pin competition. But in terms of actually how this is going to work, the long shots will be played to a giant simulator, 20 times bigger than a regular golf simulator. And then they've got this technology-based 50-yard kind of short game area, which is the size of 4 basketball courts. It's a 3,800 square foot green. But effectively, this green has been built so that the slopes on it can be changed to create variety using very clever technology. So that's the kind of gist of it. That's the concept. Having tried to absorb and digest all of that, what's your feeling on it? Are you intrigued? Are you excited to see the first event? Will you be tuning in on January 9th, Zane?
I will be tuning in because this is very different. This is definitely going to hit a different viewership. I think that I'm interested to see the tech part of it because tech's become such a big part of golf these days. That's the other part. And I think it's kind of, I don't want to use the word safe, but the way that this has been put together is being very kind of organised. They've not made masses of noise about it. They've obviously let the names, and there's still a lot of speculation around it in terms of what they've done is they've given us names of players. They've given us a bit of a model of what's going to happen, but they've not gone for the whole, this is going to be the best thing you've ever seen. So they're almost not putting themselves completely out there. And then, as you can see, from it's going to be a kind of a short, contained schedule, and it's a bit like it's almost this is going to be a bit of a test run. You know, it's a big project, but essentially they've got a window. Will this work or not work? If this doesn't work, I think they'll just go back to whatever they did before. But I think this is kind of the possible way of like how do we change? This is completely different golf because it's not even competing against. It's not a competition against what the PGA Tour or DP World already do. This is something completely separate. I think it's going to be interesting. I think it's smart because in a contained situation, the players all apply to one spot. They'll get familiar with it. They can, you know, you've not got the weather issues and so forth. The pieces I wonder about is the 1,600 fans or people in there. You know, are they going to be corporate or can you buy tickets? Will they'll bring in some atmosphere from that or not? That would be quite interesting to know. But I think to have all the best players in the same spot, it will be interesting. It won't be. It's not going to be down the 17th, 18th at Sawgrass, captivating, you know, thrilling golf. But it will add to the element part of it. As you said, like the team part of it, the franchise part of it, which is really what Live Golf are doing, just in a much safer, kind of more contained environment.
It is to professional golf, I think, what Top Golf is to real golf for us amateurs. It's a totally different experience. It's a gateway, if you like, to the game. But as we all know, there's a lot of guys that play Top Golf that will never set foot on a golf course and are not persuaded to, having played Top Golf. Their journey into golf kind of starts and ends at Top Golf, and that's fine. Some do move on, and that's great. Top Golf, I'm sure, does a good job at converting some people into golfers. And I wonder, maybe this is going to be potentially following the same model. There'll be people that tune in and some of them may end up watching PGA Tour, watching DP World Tour, and actually becoming golf fans and maybe even playing the game themselves. So
yeah, I mean, I'm interested to know how long the shows are, because that would be quite interesting. Because if it's going to distract you from your day-to-day life for half an hour, 45 minutes to an hour, I think it would do a good job.
Yeah, they're mic'd up, the players, so that'll be interesting. Again, I think it will come down to how much jeopardy are they able to create? How much drama are they able to create? Does it feel gimmicky? Does it feel manufactured? Or is it authentic? And is this just a kind of bit of a love-in for like the top players? Because at the end of the day, compelling sport requires for it to mean something and for genuine rivalries to be forged. And you want a bit of needle. You want a little bit of an edge to that competition. And that's what I think gets people interested in, like darts, for example. You know, you see that they drum up the crowd. They create this real festival atmosphere in these big events where they get an amazing atmosphere. They're pumping the music. These guys are celebrating at the Oki, and darts has been totally transformed by that model. Is this the answer, maybe, to do golf indoors?
So much of the darts comes from the crowd and the type of people that are there. And it's such a small amount of people. That's going to become a really big ticket to get in a stadium in a small closed environment with Rory McIlroy, with Tiger Woods.
Do all these golfers have to be walking out in silk shirts with their nicknames on the back, Zane?
They should do that. Now we're talking. Now we are actually talking. Pint in hand.
Yeah, that's the thing. With these get kind of gimmicky things, like I've always felt like when you mic up a player, and I love golf, don't get me wrong, you sort of realise how nerdy the sport is in many ways. You're over here.
We're not cool. Like, As cool as Tiger is chipping in at Augusta in his red shirt, the baggy jeans that he wore for it are not cool. Like, I think he knows that. And the dad trainers, he doesn't quite tick those boxes.
Yeah, look, I keep comparing it to darts. There's something so unique about those guys. They are just kind of, you feel like they're about to explode at any moment. You're Michael Van Gerwens, and they're just ready to kind of roar following some kind of ridiculous 9 darter. Are we going to see that emotion? Because I think that's one of the things that Liv didn't capture, as far as I'm concerned. You know, yes, you've got all the champagne and the celebrations on the green and stuff, but that real team dynamic where you've got this eruption of sort of team celebration that the Ryder Cup does so well in such a unique way, as Guy was talking about earlier on in this podcast. We haven't managed to take that into the realm of regular golf yet. And I'm not sure we ever can. I'm not sure it's possible to convert it. But, you know, when you're looking to do something from a team perspective, it's how can you galvanize and how can you create that dynamic that will pull people in and get them tuning in and actually develop fans of certain teams and certain franchises.
The team element is the one. You know, you got what you've got a lot of players that are already really, really popular. And from a team point of view, you will get people who are like, that's my team. I'm the Tiger team or the Rory team or the John Rahm team. And I think that's one thing that Liv hasn't quite captured yet. We all know those teams, but not many people are choosing a team just yet. And that's where it really lies. It is like, I want that team to win. I dislike that team. It's like those both sides of it. I think that's where this has got a chance to pick up steam pretty quickly, because you've got a lot of popular golfers in there.
You're going to be tuning in on January the 9th. If you had to make a prediction, do you think you'll still be watching come the end of the season? Do you think it will capture your attention for its entire run?
That's a really good question. Yes, I think it will. I want team golf in
this
golf.
Goes back to the fact that you and I can't help ourselves. Yeah.
I won't be doing anything else. I'll be on Instagram looking at golf swings, so I'll just watch these ones. It's the best players in the world. Like I think in any situation, if you get to see a small clip of Scottie Scheffler and Tiger Woods having like a little chipping session, which is doing the rounds on social media, for instance, like that's so captivating. And I think if it, you know, like so much of today, if the content teams there can do a good job and catch a small moment, I think actually the spectacle of them actually competing is like, we don't need any more of that. We're not that bothered. But what we want to see is like, can we get a bit more behind of what goes on? What is Tiger like in those situations? You know, he's coming into that time. All the little snippets, all the maybe the little tips that they go like, you know, is there going to be a little piece where Justin Thomas turns to Jordan Spieth and says to him like, man, you keep pulling it. Like, I've told you about this before. You know, you got to weaken your right-hand grip. Like, those are the small moments which would be really good for the players because like it or not, you know, like we're lucky to be around professional golfers. I've been around professional golfers, you know, for the last, like, since I was 16 years old. And what I'm looking forward to seeing is that everyone else can see that professional golfers are just like you and I in terms of, or every 15 handicap golfer who's getting into golf. Like, they watch YouTube clips. They'll be sitting at a tournament and we'll be sitting around dinner and saying, look at what this coach has just posted. And you can tell that it's not like, oh, this is ridiculous. It's like, you know, like, when he's warming up tomorrow, he shot a 74 today, I know that he's going to try that. Or what? We have those same conversations, and I'm like, I'm really looking forward to that possibly coming out, because they're humans, and we don't get that until now.
Yeah, and I think it's got good social media potential. You can see some of those little exchanges going viral. You're absolutely right. You know, Tiger, Scotty, it's that insight, how they play a bunker shot. It's that kind of stuff. If they're mic'd up, if they're in the mood, then yeah, you could potentially get some really good content that you wouldn't get from regular golf tournaments. So I'm intrigued by it. I'm a little bit on the fence in terms of whether I think it's going to work long term, but it's January the 9th. It is the TGL League. It's something brand new for 2024 to go on top of the newly revamped DP World Tour schedule, the second year of this enhanced PGA Tour schedule.
I'm excited for this TGL. Yeah. Now we just had a little chat
well,
about it.
There we go. Yeah, you're already marking it in your calendar, Zane. I knew you would be. That was a silly question, really. Of course you're going to be excited by it. In the meantime, in the present, we are building up to the DP World Tour Championship. You can catch our full preview on the next episode. We're going to be in conversation with a good friend of yours, a winner on the DP World Tour this season, Todd Clements as well, Zane. Looking forward to finding out exactly the story behind Todd's game, because amazing, he actually came through the system here in the Middle East on the MENA Tour.
Yeah, absolutely. He's a really interesting character, an interesting journey that he's had to this point. Loads and loads of insight. So we'll get him in and we'll give him a really good grilling.
Yes, right, we will. That's it. Yeah, and exactly that. You're a good friend of his, so I'm going to leave that task to you. You're here for the next few days. Looking forward to doing another podcast in the next few days as well. Thank you so much for listening, guys. Really appreciate it. We're into our seventh episode now, so we're picking up a little bit of momentum, a little bit of steam, if you like. And we really appreciate you guys tuning in. We'd love a subscription. You can find us on Apple Podcasts. You can find us on Spotify as well. Please leave us a review and catch the next episode. Preview for the DP World Tour Championship. It is the first tee with DP World Tour. And for now, from both myself and Zane, it's goodbye and happy golfing.
The first tee